You know, that incredibly specific cinematic fantasy we all kind of secretly harbor when things just go catastrophically wrong.
Oh yeah, like the whole knight in shining armor thing.
Right, exactly. Like your project stalls out, or the budget totally dries up, or you just hit an absolute wall in your career. We have this movie script expectation playing in our heads.
Yeah, that if you just stand there looking sufficiently overwhelmed, someone's gonna save you.
Totally. Like if
Yeah.
we look helpless enough, the universe is going to send, I don't know, a benevolent VP
Yeah.
or a random angel investor who's just going to pull over, roll down their window, and fix the whole mess for us.
I mean, we completely buy into that illusion, right?
Oh.
We think that our sheer level of need is like a magnet that attracts the rescue.
Yeah, like desperation is a flare gun.
Exactly. But in reality, desperation usually just makes people roll their windows up and drive a little faster.
Which is, you know, a really tough pill to swallow.
Oh.
But today we are tearing into a concept that just shatters that illusion entirely. And I think it replaces it with something far more empowering for you.
Yeah, it really does.
We've been doing a deep dive into the advanced copy of Chapter 4 from the upcoming book, Laws of Life, Book 2, Now Design the System for Your Life.
Right, and for anyone tracking the series, this is the highly anticipated follow-up to the Amazon bestseller, Laws of Life, Book 1, Ditch the System, Design Your Life.
Yeah, and you can find all the info on those frameworks over at jackslaws.com. But I have to say, the core argument in this chapter, that help almost never comes when you are just sitting still, it's really forcing me to rethink a lot of my own professional habits.
I mean, the chapter introduces this law of physics applied to human behavior, you know?
Yeah.
It argues that success comes from effort, and once that effort starts, it compounds.
Right. But before we get into the actual mechanics of how that compounding works, we probably need to establish how you and I are filtering this information today.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because we are looking at this through two completely opposite career lenses.
Totally opposite. Like, my lens is strictly corporate. I am a dedicated, high-achieving employee. I genuinely love navigating the corporate matrix, climbing the ladder, and I have like zero desire to ever build or run my own business.
Zero.
Zero. The mere thought of like managing payroll or bootstrapping a startup makes me break out in hives.
That is so funny because my world is the exact inverse. I mean, I'm a serial entrepreneur. I've built small companies. I've scaled large companies from the ground up.
Right, you love that stuff.
I do. My entire reality is governed by the mechanics of risk and investment and building something out of nothing.
But the fascinating thread running through this chapter is that whether you're trying to secure the corner office at a Fortune 500 or you're trying to get, you know, seed funding from a VC, the physics of attracting help operate on the exact same frequency.
Motion creates momentum, and momentum attracts investment.
Exactly. So let's ground that in the visceral real-world story the author uses to kick off the chapter.
Oh, the highway breakdown.
Yeah, it's 1993. He's moving to Texas in a $400 Mustang the second. And he gets onto the LBJ freeway in Dallas during rush hour.
And if you've never driven the LBJ, it is essentially a concrete gladiator arena.
It's terrifying. So
Oh.
suddenly his timing belt blows, the car goes completely dead in the second lane of the four-lane highway. Cars are just flying by at 60 miles an hour, horns blaring, and he is sitting there terrified of getting rear-ended.
Which is a nightmare.
Right. Now, the natural instinct, going back to that movie script fantasy, is to just sit on the trunk, throw your hands up, and wait for a tow truck or the cops to save you.
But doing that would have guaranteed he sat there for hours, or, you know, worse, caused a massive pileup.
Right.
Instead, he turns on the flashers, opens his door, puts his shoulder into the frame of the car, and physically starts pushing this dead block of metal uphill toward the shoulder. He literally puts himself in motion.
And that physical motion changes the entire environment around him. Because a guy in a truck pulls up behind him, rolls down the window, yells, get in, I'll push you, and uses the bumper of his truck to push the Mustang all the way to safety.
Which is incredible.
And then the guy hands the author this brick-sized 1993 cell phone so he can call a friend, and then the guy just drives
He
off.
just leaves.
Yeah. But the author asks a really brilliant analytical question here. Like, if he had just been sitting on the trunk of that car looking pitiful and waiting to be saved, would that driver have stopped?
Not a chance. I mean, the driver in the truck didn't stop out of pure altruistic charity for a helpless victim, you know.
No, definitely not.
He stopped because he saw a guy doing absolutely everything in his physical power to solve his own problem. The rescuer didn't want to adopt a dependent. He saw an opportunity to provide like the last 10% of the energy required for a solution.
Yeah, when we see someone giving their absolute all, it triggers this deep psychological response. We want to partner with that energy.
Exactly. We think, oh, this person is already moving the needle. My small contribution will actually guarantee the win.
It makes me think of a concept from physics that just perfectly maps onto human behavior. Static friction versus kinetic friction.
Oh, yeah. Break that down.
So if you ever tried to slide a massive, heavy oak desk across a carpeted room, you know the hardest part is the first inch.
Oh, it's brutal.
Right. It takes a massive amount of physical energy to get that object to budge from a dead stop. But once it's sliding, once you overcome that static friction and move into kinetic friction, it takes significantly less energy to keep it moving.
You can almost push it with one hand at that point.
Exactly. And the human equivalent of static friction is a victim mentality. It is incredibly exhausting to try and help someone who isn't helping themselves.
Yeah, I see this all the time. Investors, whether they're investing capital in a startup or, you know, investing political capital in an employee, they do not want to expend all their energy just overcoming your static friction.
Which completely reframes this chronic complaint I hear in the corporate world. People love to say, oh, the rich get richer, or the successful people get all the breaks. It's just luck.
Right, the luck excuse.
It is so much easier to blame luck than to acknowledge physics. Those successful people are operating with kinetic energy. They are already sliding the heavy desk across the room.
So when a VP or a mentor comes along, just adding a little push yields a massive result.
Exactly. Static energy, like sitting around the break room complaining about how unfair the system is, that attracts pity at best. And pity has never, in the history of corporate America, resulted in a promotion.
That is so true. And if you take that kinetic energy concept and apply it to the entrepreneurial side, the book illustrates it perfectly with the story of Joel Salatin.
Remind me, he's the farmer, right?
Yeah, long before he was this world-famous farmer teaching thousands of people about, like, 100% grass-fed beef and pastured pork, he was completely broke.
Like, struggling to keep the lights on broke?
Exactly. He and his wife were pioneering these regenerative farming methods that were super unusual at the time. All their capital was tied up in the next production run. And then their only farm vehicle suffers a terminal breakdown. The engine is just dead.
Oh, man. For a farm just getting off the ground, that isn't a setback. That is an existential business killer.
Utterly catastrophic. But here is where the compounding effect of prior motion kicks in.
Okay.
A customer hears about the dead vehicle. This customer actually drives out to Joel's farm in a beat up but fully functional car with someone else following them in a second vehicle.
Wait, really?
Yeah. The customer walks up to Joel, tosses him the keys, and says the car is his.
Just gives it to him.
When Joel tries to protest and refuse the charity, the man essentially tells him to shut up and take the car. It was a gift, free and clear.
Which sounds completely insane on the surface. Mm-hmm. People do not just hand out cars.
No, they don't. But when you look at the underlying mechanics, it wasn't charity at all. It was a strategic investment.
Because Joel was already producing value.
Exactly. Joel was successfully providing something that customer valued highly, which was clean, locally raised, healthy food. The customer looked at Joel's operation and realized that Joel staying in business was way more valuable to him than, like, the Kelly Blue Book trade in value of that old sedan.
Wow. So he was investing in a winning operation to protect his own interests.
Exactly. Joel had worked hard enough to generate a baseline of success. That success proved his competence, and that competence attracted external support.
It's that winning team mentality. The text actually points to a fascinating psychological layer here, mentioning a brain games television experiment.
Oh, the one with the red and blue teams?
Yeah. They took an audience and divided them into a red team and a blue team based on a completely arbitrary metric. Like, birthdays from January to June were red, July to December were blue.
Totally random.
Completely. And within minutes, these absolute strangers were fiercely emotionally invested in their random team winning.
It's wild how fast that happens.
Mm-hmm. Right. We are biologically hardwired to want to be associated with a winning tribe. It's in our DNA. We instinctively want to align ourselves with momentum.
But, you know, that abstract idea of momentum gets really messy when you transition from a clear-cut highway breakdown to the ambiguity of, like, a random Tuesday afternoon when you're just grinding away at a desk.
Oh, for sure. The emotional roller coaster of daily work can completely obscure whether you are actually in motion or just spinning your tires.
So let's filter that daily grind through our respective lenses, starting with your world in the corporate sector. How does this law of compounding effort show up there?
Well, the book uses the story of Forrest Baker, a VP of operations. He's trying to mentor this new hotshot regional sales rep.
Okay.
Baker sits him down and explains the brutal reality of complex B2B sales. He tells this rep, "Look, selling a highly technical managed switch to a room full of skeptical engineers is not like selling basic Cat 5 cable to a facilities manager."
A totally different beast.
But the sales cycle takes 6 to 12 agonizing months. You have to win over the engineers, survive brutal internal security audits from completely different departments, and then battle purchasing agents who are demanding competitive bids for a product only your company makes.
It's a 12-month gauntlet where literally any single person can veto the deal.
Exactly. And Baker gives this young rep an incredible piece of psychological armor. He says, "You are going to get little wins along that timeline. Like you get invited into the demo lab or you pass the security audit."
Right.
Baker tells him he has to use those small wins for emotional motivation to keep pushing, but he delivers this really crucial warning. He says, "They are wins, but they are not victories."
Man, that distinction, the gap between a win and a victory, that's where so many people lose their momentum.
As someone who carries a sales quota, I feel that distinction in my bones. Every January 1st, my bag resets to absolute zero.
Right, you start over.
The executives above me do not care that I crushed it last November. They want to know what I am closing this week. So this brings up a massive question for you on the entrepreneurial side.
Lay it on me.
If momentum is so critical, how do you keep yourself or your startup team from coasting? Like, how do you prevent that fatal mistake of popping the champagne over a small win and treating it like a final victory?
That is the ultimate trap of early momentum. But the book provides a brilliant template for avoiding that trap through the story of Patrick Seaman.
Oh, from AudioNet.
Yeah, Patrick was the technical genius behind AudioNet, which eventually became Broadcast.com before the massive Yahoo buyout.
Right.
Try to contextualize this. He figured out how to make scalable audio streaming work when, 80% of the world was still listening to the dial-up modem screeching at them.
Just getting a single audio file to play in the 90s was a miracle, let alone building an entire platform.
Right. The friction was astronomically high. So after the buyout, Patrick walks away with serious capital. The movie script ending says he goes to a beach and just stops.
Retires.
Yeah. Instead, he builds a home studio. He starts an audiobook company before the public even really conceptualized digital audiobooks. He launches multiple streaming companies.
Wow.
And because he never stopped his own motion, investors were actively throwing money at him. He didn't have to go on a grueling roadshow to beg for capital. His previous massive victories made him the safest bet in the room. He was a walking generator of kinetic energy.
You know, the author actually experienced a micro version of this same phenomenon when building his own podcast network,
He
right?
did. He started with a $30 digital recorder he bought for his car. But he didn't just record into the void. He set winnable public goals to build momentum.
Like the subscriber goal.
Yeah, he told his tiny audience he wanted to hit 1,000 subscribers in a year. To force the issue, he ran a grassroots contest. Enter by telling 3 friends about the show, and you could win an iPod Nano engraved with the phrase, "Be an ant, not a grasshopper."
Which is such a weird specific prize that it actually makes people want to talk about it.
It really does. And the compounding effect was explosive. He hit 2,500 subscribers, which snowballed into 25,000. People were literally burning physical CDs of his podcast and handing them out at conferences.
That is so old school. I love it.
And it gets better. One listener voluntarily bought and shipped him a professional broadcasting microphone simply because they wanted the show they loved to sound better.
Oh, wow.
A top-tier Hollywood video editor reached out and produced a promotional intro video entirely for free. He eventually landed on Glenn Beck's radar, not through pitching a producer, but purely through the gravitational pull of his audience's momentum.
But, you know, the author didn't achieve that just by blindly throwing spaghetti at the wall.
Yeah.
You don't scale an audience or a startup just by working hard. You have to work a system.
Absolutely.
Relying purely on gut feelings and raw effort is how you end up burning out. We really need to decode the actual system he uses to process this feedback without getting emotionally derailed.
Right. And the book introduces a framework called the ARCAR method, ARCAR. It is essentially an emotional bypass valve for processing wins and losses so you maintain your kinetic energy.
Walk us through the mechanics of that acronym because the middle step seems to be where everyone just crashes.
Okay, so the first step is ACT. You have to do something that forces a real-world response. Make the sales call, publish the article, launch the beta software. As the saying goes, you cannot steer a parked car.
True.
The second step is reflect. This is where you have to look at the outcome like you're reading gauges on a machine, rather than looking into a mirror that reflects your self-worth.
Right. Did the customer buy it? Did the audience click it? Just read the data.
Exactly. Just the data. The third step is critique. And this is the crucible. You have to find the actual cause and effect. Why did it work or why did it fail? This is where the vast majority of people lie to themselves to protect their ego.
Oh, big time.
Fourth is adjust. You take the brutal truth you found in the critique phase and you tweak the approach. You don't throw a temper tantrum, scrap the whole project, and start over from scratch. You refine the existing motion.
Right, you make a micro adjustment.
Yeah. And finally, repeat. Success is not a singular event you cross off a list. It is the continuous grinding cycle of action and correction.
Let's linger on that critique phase for a second, because the text uses a brilliant fishing analogy that exposes exactly why our egos fight this process so hard.
Oh, the fishing analogy is perfect.
Right. Imagine you're out on a new lake. You've done the research. You've studied the GPS topographical maps. You've located the underwater drop-offs. You anchor the boat, cast your line, and you get absolutely nothing.
Nothing but weeds.
Yeah. You change lures. You cast again. Still nothing. You are frustrated. You're convinced the lake is dead. And you're just about to pull up the anchor. And right at that exact moment, another guy motors up 20 yards away, drops his line, and immediately starts pulling fish after fish into his boat.
There is literally nothing more infuriating than watching someone effortlessly succeed in the exact spot where you are failing.
It's the worst.
Yeah.
But if you apply the RCAR method, you realize your instinct on the location was actually dead right. The fish are there. Your act and reflect phases proved you found the structure.
Right.
What was wrong was your presentation. Maybe his lure is a slightly darker shade of green, or, you know, he's reeling it in just a fraction of a second slower, allowing it to bounce off the bottom differently.
And that analogy perfectly sets up the book's redefinition of insanity. I mean, we've all heard the tired cliche, insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results.
Right.
But the book flips that on its head to define sanity. The definition of sanity is doing things slightly differently over and over until you find the results you're looking for.
Which translates directly to the corporate boardroom. I see the human equivalent of this fishing analogy play out constantly. Mm. A mid-level employee watches the quote-unquote star coworker get the massive promotion or the coveted project lead.
Oh.
And instead of entering the critique phase, the employee retreats into their ego. They start asking juvenile defensive questions like, why them? It's not fair. Mm. I log just as many hours. My spreadsheets are just as accurate.
They view the promotion as a lottery they didn't win rather than an outcome of specific adjustable variables.
Exactly. They're asking why them instead of asking the only question that matters, which is what am I missing?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that star coworker isn't actually smarter. Maybe they just present their data differently in the executive meetings.
Their retrieve speed is different.
Right. Maybe their retrieve speed is just better calibrated to the specific communication style the VP is looking for.
Yeah.
But I have to push back on you here from the entrepreneur's perspective. It is very easy for us to sit here and say, just read the gauges on the machine. But we are human beings.
We are.
When your startup idea completely flatlines, or a huge corporate presentation you worked on for months just completely bombs in front of the board, how do you actually stop your ego from taking the critique phase and a personal indictment of your worth?
Well, it requires a profound mental rewiring. You have to actively separate your personal identity from your professional iteration.
Okay, how so?
Think about a scientist in a lab. If they run a chemical experiment and it fails to produce the desired compound, they don't break down crying and say, I am a fundamentally bad person.
No, of course not.
Right. They look at the data and say, the hypothesis was incorrect. Let's adjust the temperature variable by 2 degrees. When you finally internalize that the market or your boss or the venture capitalist isn't rejecting you as a human being, they are simply giving you objective data on your approach, it frees you to keep moving.
Well, that's a huge shift.
It is. Success doesn't emerge all at once, you know? It emerges entirely through motion. The real failure isn't the setback. The real failure is stopping the RCAR process entirely.
Or, to loop it back to Forrest Baker's warning to that young sales rep, the failure is mistaking a small temporary win for the final finish line and letting your kinetic energy dissipate.
Precisely. You have to fall in love with the unglamorous process of micro adjustments.
Yeah. The author wraps this chapter up by essentially providing us with a new mental operating system to install. He gives us three lines of code to reprogram how we approach these stalls in momentum.
These are so good.
The first piece of code you have to install is realizing that success breeds success. You have to actively command your brain to find something, literally anything, no matter how small, that you can hit head on today to generate that first spark of kinetic friction.
The second line of code is a constant internal reminder. Help shows up after you act, not before. You have to completely kill the rescue fantasy.
And the third line is the ego killer. When you are failing in the exact same waters where others are pulling fish into the boat, you have to force your brain to find the small adjustment they have made that you haven't.
Right. What are you missing?
Exactly. So we want to challenge you directly right now. Look at whatever goal is currently stalling out in your life. Maybe it's getting your health in order. Maybe it's finally launching that side hustle you've been outlining for 2 years. Or maybe it's going after that senior director role at your company.
Stop waiting for the perfect economic conditions. Stop waiting for the perfect mentor to arrive and just hand you a customized map.
The reality is, the map only reveals itself after you take the first step into the fog.
It really does.
So I want to leave you with a final lingering thought to mull over today. Imagine if there was a hidden camera broadcasting your professional life right now to a room full of potential investors, executive mentors, or whoever has the power to change your trajectory.
Oh, that's a tough mirror.
Look objectively at your actions over the past 7 days. Would that room see someone sitting on the side of the highway, hazard lights off, just staring down the road waiting for a tow truck to magically appear? Or would they see someone sweating, shoulder pressed against the bumper, pushing that dead car up the hill with absolutely everything they've got? What is one specific action you can take tomorrow morning that proves to the world and to yourself that you are already in motion?